He's Hacker.
I like a good serial killer documentary. He hasn't taken the pounding that wide receivers take.
It's just a pound job, and guys are tired towards that 4 minute.
And he doesn't shy away from opinion.
I would be lying to you if I said I had not heard things. They're like a bad rash. You hear a lot of things. Some are true, some aren't.
It's Hacker After Dark on 1010XL.
Talk about a Gordon Solie shot to the solar plexus for Gator Nation. I feel for you. That sucks. That was bad. Florida season comes to an end in Indianapolis, Indiana. Colorado, 102, Florida, 100. Ugh. We'll talk all about it tonight. Welcome on in. Friday night edition, Hacker After Dark, 1010XL, 92.5 FM. At least Florida's in good company, right? Mississippi State, South Carolina, Kentucky, Auburn, and Florida. All five SEC teams that have been eliminated already in round one of the NCAA tournament. It was one of the great regular seasons for the SEC in men's college basketball. It has been a borderline nightmare in the first round of the NCAA tournament. We'll certainly give you my thoughts on Florida and kind of what happened, where they go from here. I got something that some of you will not like to hear, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's never really stopped me before. So we'll get into that in just a moment. We're going to do a lot of NFL tonight as well, a lot of Jaguars. We'll kick it off with Steve Palazzolo of PFF, Pro Football Focus. Love talking ball with Steve of PFF and the PFF podcast. He's going to join us in less than 15 minutes. Also, Shane Hallam of DraftCountdown.com. Look, free agency is basically in the rearview mirror. We know what the Jaguars added. We know what they lost. We know where they spent money. What is left now to improve this roster? Well, I think we got to take a firm look at corner, right? A firm look at wide receiver. So we're going to spend some time with Shane Hallam of Draft Countdown, a guy that does seven-round mock drafts every week on his website and has done so for years, about the wide receiver class, about the corner class in this upcoming draft, and also get his thoughts on what the Jaguars were able to accomplish in free agency. So we're glad you're with us on a Friday to end the week with you here on Hacker After Dark. Every night on HAD, we do give you a big deal of the night and Dylan Denmark. Let's do that right now.
Time now for the big deal of the night.
What's the big deal?
What is the big deal?
No big deal.
It is a big deal.
On Hacker After Dark.
Yeah, that was bad. I just assumed Florida lose the game by 20, which I thought that was where it was going with about 4 minutes to go. And then all of a sudden, Colorado started to play the clock and not play basketball. They were content with just running 35 seconds off the shot clock. Well, that's all great. But when you don't score and your opponent keeps scoring, that's ultimately going to be a little bit of a problem. And it was. Walter Clayton drills the three with 6 seconds to go. The Gators came storming back from down double digits in the final moments to tie the game at 100. And then bam. Colorado hits a shot. It was like the Kawhi Leonard shot for Toronto a few years ago, right? That thing, I think, hit every part of the rim and fell in. And even after that, Walter Clayton heaved it from 70 feet that would have won the game, and it did hit the backboard. I mean, it was close. But in the end, the Gators season does come to an end. I look at this in two different ways, two very different ways. And I think they're both true. You should be upset about losing to Colorado. You were the higher seed. Colorado had to play another game on Wednesday night just to get here. Less than 48 hours later, they're on the court against you. You score 100 points and you still lose. Again, kudos to Colorado for their shooting, but the Gator defense left a lot to be desired for a good majority of that game. So, yeah, A lot of people were mad. A lot of people were upset. Officials, you know, whatever. I didn't have much of a problem with the officiating. I know that's a rite of passage for Gator fans when you lose in any sport. It's the officials' fault, so I'm sure most of you are blaming the officials as you normally do. I thought bad calls happen on both sides. At the end of the day, though, you should be upset that you lost the game. Your season's over. You can't lose to a team that played in Dayton 40 hours ago. You should have won the game. Having said that, you're not going to want to hear this right now because you're enjoying being angry and being upset. But like I told Rick, if you would have told me when the Gators started 1-3 in conference play and people were telling and calling and texting me saying Todd Golden's no better than Mike White, another bad hire, Florida's not going anywhere, this second-year head coach, they won't even make the tournament, they're awful. Everybody was saying that after the 1-3 start in conference. But then something happened in the midway point of the year. They started finding themselves. They started hitting shots. They started doing some nice things. And from 1-3 in SEC play at the beginning to 24 wins, an appearance in the SEC finals in the tournament, and a 7 seed in the NCAA tournament returning to the big dance for the first time in a couple of years. I think most Gator fans, you would have taken that after the 1-3 start in conference. Now, I know we're not going to talk about that tonight, right? That'll be a conversation for a week or two down the road after you decompress from essentially losing at the buzzer earlier this afternoon. But Todd Golden's got this program with a green arrow moving forward. I like what he did. I think he answered a lot of the questions about him. And I think he's going to be the guy in Gainesville. And he proved last year how unbelievably successful he can be in the transfer portal. They're going to need to do that again, right? They're going to lose Zion Pullen. They're going to lose Tyrese Samuel. They may lose Walter Clayton. We don't know. But Golden did a heck of a job in the portal last year. If he does it again, I think you should expect him to do it again. I think Florida will be in great shape going into next season. It sucks now because you lose a game in that fashion to Colorado. Big picture, Todd Golden's going to be good for the Florida Gator basketball program. And once you have a few days to reflect, I think you'll see that. As far as the Southeastern Conference, I don't have any answers for you. You know, I had a lot of college basketball analysts on this year. From my buddy Mark Wise of ESPN to Mike DeCourcy of the Sporting News, Jerry Palm, CBSSports.com. We had a lot of guys on covering the world of college basketball. And I asked every one of them, is the SEC the best conference in college basketball? Because I think it was a fair question. The SEC at times had, at certain times this year, 10 of the 14 schools were ranked in the top 25 at one time, or at one point. At one point, 10 of the 14 were ranked in the top 25. You got 8 schools in the NCAA tournament. But good grief, man. In the last 29 hours, it has been a bloodbath. Mississippi State got boat raced by Michigan State. South Carolina did not belong on the court with Oregon. Kentucky loses to a 14 seed in Oakland. That's Oakland, Michigan, by the way. Florida loses darn near at the buzzer to Colorado. And Auburn had every chance in the world to win, and they lose to the Ivy League tourney champions from Yale. And all 5 of those teams, Kentucky, Auburn, Florida, South Carolina, and Mississippi State, all were the higher seed. All of them lost to lower seeds. And in the case of Florida, in the case of South Carolina, in the case of Auburn, and in the case of Kentucky, they lost to double-digit seeds. Yikes. Probably the story of the tournament right now. 1-5 for the SEC. The only win was Tennessee, who beat that powerhouse known as the Peacocks of St. Peter's. The SEC right now trying to save face. Texas A&M has scored 58 points at halftime. Apparently Nebraska is just not playing defense. Denmark, how do you score 58 points and a half in college basketball?
Either shoot a lot of threes or teams not playing defense, you get a lot of layups.
I mean, they gave up 44. Nebraska's got 44 of their own. 58-44 at the half between A&M and Nebraska. Good grief.
At 17 in the first 5 minutes.
Ugh. Alabama losing early to Charleston. That would top off the awful first 2 days if Alabama loses to Charleston. That's a 12-10 lead early in the first half. We'll keep you updated. My bracket's not even worth going over. It's completely obliterated. It's destroyed. I was at one time 13-6 after 19 games. I'm no longer that. I did have Florida losing in the round of 32, though. I mean, look, I thought if they beat Colorado, they would lose to Marquette, so I'm not overly surprised the Gators are out. I'm very surprised Auburn's out. I'm very surprised Kentucky's out. Not good for the Southeastern Conference. Not good. Denmark, quickly, you're a Gator alum. Man, you got the orange and blue blood. You upset? You frustrated? You mad? Your thoughts?
Couldn't care less, really. I mean, Colorado's just playing good. Like, the Colorado team that played a couple of nights ago was the completely different team that played tonight. They had no answer for that big man for Colorado. And, I mean, I move on. Like, I'm not one of those people that watched every basketball game. I watched the last month and a half, and kind of like everybody else when I started getting hot. But I'm not one of those people that's going to, you know, put my head down and be mad about it.
This was a good prelude for me because I'm so invested in the Orlando Magic right now. All I'm thinking about when Florida is losing to Colorado is I got the Sacramento Kings coming in town tomorrow night. We got 12 games to go in the regular season. The Magic currently sit at the 4th spot in the Eastern Conference. But this was a good appetizer because I know in about a month and a half at Madison Square Garden in Game 5 of the Eastern Conference first round, Jalen Brunson's going to hit one at the buzzer because that's just my luck as a sports fan. And I know this 6 weeks in advance. So it was good to have a little dose of it today so that I can prepare myself for when the Magic lose in absolutely devastating fashion in about 6 weeks. I think supporting Orlando for the last 30 years and being an objective broadcast journalist, of course, when it comes to the Jaguars, I have been trained to expect the worst, the absolute worst. I have been beaten down so much by the Magic, by the Jaguars, by the Gator football program and the basketball team, quite frankly, over the last, you know, 15 years, that I no longer am a glass half full guy when it comes to my fandom. I always think the things are going to be awful and negative and the worst thing imaginable. And lo and behold, that happened today, and I fully expect it to happen to the Magic in about a month and a half time. Speaking of that, Zach Hanshew of Roto World covering the NBA, he comes up with us here in the 9 o'clock hour. But back into the NFL. Again, we'll keep you updated on the NCAA tournament. Back into the National Football League. PFF, Pro Football Focus. I know you guys love analytics. Analytics has grown on me. I really like what they do at Pro Football Focus. And one of my favorites over there is Steve Palazzolo. He's always kind enough to join us here on Hacker After Dark. Steve of the PFF podcast. I want to ask him straight up, are the Jacksonville Jaguars better today than they were 75 days ago when the season ended in Nashville? We're going to recap free agency. We're going to get his thoughts. And Jaguar fans, I'm not necessarily sure if you're going to like everything he has to say. That's coming up next. Hacker After Dark on a Friday night in Jacksonville, Florida, right here on 1010XL, 92.5 FM.
Let's ring up another guest on the All-Pro Roofing phone line.
Back here on 1010XL at 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. Boy, it's been a very interesting two-week period here in Jacksonville. Guys getting released, guys getting retained, and a lot of free agents brought in, and of course one notable free agent that is no longer here. Let's talk about all of it with Steve Palazzolo of Pro Football Focus, PFF. We always love the folks over at PFF, and Steve's always kind enough to join us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Steve, how you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Hey, Steve, always appreciate the time, man. All right, before we look at it individually, just your thoughts in totality, what the Jacksonville Jaguars did, or maybe in some instances did not, over the last 2 weeks here in free agency.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably more uncomfortable than it is comfortable for Jags fans at the moment. I think, you know, when I look at the offseason, it's not always about every move being the perfect move to build the roster. But I think overall you want to make sure that in free agency, first, second, and third wave of free agency, you're filling your needs so you can get into the draft with just no holes on the roster, at least not in the starting 22, so you can draft the best players, look forward. And I think the Jags, again, there'll be some discomfort with no Calvin Ridley, you know, some question marks around Gabe Davis at receiver. I do love what they did with Eric Armstead. We could talk about all those for sure, but I think there's probably a little bit of angst, you know, going in with a few more question marks, I think, top to bottom on the roster maybe than when they came in.
Certainly the biggest story is, let's begin there, Calvin Ridley gone. He goes to Tennessee. They paid him a lot of money, Steve, no question about that, and he even alluded to that last week when he was introduced in Nashville, that money, you know, was nice of what he got from the Titans. So he's gone. Gabe Davis comes in. He's not even 25 years old yet, which is shocking to me. He turns 25 next month. He brings his 27 career touchdowns down here to Duval County. What do you make of Gabe Davis now being on the Jaguars?
Yeah, I mean, I think Davis is it's funny because he's one of those guys that's either over or underrated depending on your perspective. I think because he had that incredible playoff game against the Chiefs where he had four touchdowns, I think it was just his second year in the league, right? I mean, everybody expected this, you know, massive step forward in years three and four, and he never really got that from Gabe Davis. But if you look at it, from a high level as a fourth round pick, very productive player and a guy that could become a deep threat, vertical threat. And I think that's, extremely valuable, obviously, in today's NFL, being able to stretch the field. So I think the goal there is to kind of get him back on track. I think you see this a lot with receivers where they fit with specific roles. And I think that's where Gabe Davis is more of that vertical threat, not the guy that's going to be necessarily a high volume. I don't think he's a true wide receiver one. I think there's really only 15 or 20 of those guys anyway. So yeah, as long as expectations are set there, let that guy stretch the field, give Trevor Lawrence a guy to create chunk plays with.
The Jaguars received a pretty good amount of criticism 2 years ago when they brought Christian Kirk in. All the talk, he's never been a 1,000-yard receiver. Kirk has come in here and flourished when he's been healthy. Gabe Davis, do you see something similar? Could lightning strike twice now that maybe he's out from behind Stephon Diggs?
I think there's elements of that. Similar to Kirk, you know, I think when Kirk's done his best work, you're moving him around. He's in the slot. He's outside. Gets a bunch of the scheme plays from that offense. And it is all about playing the strengths, you know. And I think, you know, they do complement each other well, Christian Kirk and Gabe Davis. And to me, building a receiving core is all about having different answers, different options for what defenses are going to throw at you. Not necessarily just having a true wide receiver one, but having different styles and types. And that's where I think Christian Kirk, Gabe Davis, they're going to, you know, with Zay Jones in there as well, with Evan Engram at tight end, you have different types of players, different styles. And, you know, week to week, I think it's going to be, who's going to determine game plan oriented, you know, who's getting all those targets. And I think Gabe Davis does have an opportunity to be a big play receiver opposite what Christian Kirk's bringing to the table.
Steve Palazzolo of Pro Football Focus here with us on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Steve, Gabe Davis is not coming alone. Mitch Morse also from Buffalo. Look, the Jaguars had problems at center last year. We've talked a lot about Luke Fortner's struggles. What did you make of Mitch Morse here with the Jaguars?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be an upgrade. I mean, he's been just a good solid player for the majority of his career in Buffalo. I think the consistency factor, you know, he plays his 1,000 snaps, doesn't miss a lot of time. He's been a very solid pass protector, okay in the run game. But I think that's an upgrade overall, right? So, Morse is, that's what he is at this point. You know what you're getting, whether it was in Kansas City or in Buffalo. He's been a very good player. And, again, a solid presence and a big presence at center. I think a lot of teams are are trying to make sure that they have size at center these days with, you know, how explosive some of the nose tackles are, but how big some of the nose tackles are as well. And, you know, Morris definitely brings that to the table.
Steve, there's no doubt the Jaguar offensive line struggled at times last year. Trevor was banged up quite a bit. If the starting offensive line on opening day is as it appears, Cam Robinson, Ezra Cleveland, Mitch Morse, Brandon Sheriff, Anton Harrison, is that an offensive line you can win with, in your opinion?
I think it is. Now, the way I look at offensive lines is, you know, just don't be bad, right? Just don't be awful. And so, you know, from a pass protection standpoint, I think it's solid. You know, Cam Robinson, I think, has gotten better through the years. That tends to happen with offensive linemen. I thought he was off to a very slow start his first 3 or 4 years, but he's improved. You're hoping for the same from Anton Harrison in year two. Again, offensive linemen usually take a few years. Not many of them actually hit the ground running and become very good players right away. They sometimes take a year or 3 or 4. So you kind of hope that Harrison will accelerate that. And then on the other end, you kind of hope Brandon Sheriff isn't too far on the downswing of his career. But I like Ezra Cleveland. I think he's been a solid player throughout the majority of his career. But it's one of those offensive lines where when I look at it on paper, they're about middle of the pack type of offensive line. They're an average type of offensive line, which on paper I think is good. It's fine. You can win with that. But they also, if they all hit the wrong side of variance, as we say, as the nerds would say, if they hit the, you know, the bottom end of their range of outcomes, it could be ugly again. So it's always good to add depth and, you know, try to fortify it even more.
And what's interesting, Walker Little and Luke Fortner, two guys that have played a lot of football, are now backups on this offensive line in the event some injuries do pile up. Steve, the biggest splash Jacksonville made, you alluded to him earlier, Arik Armstead, 24 hours after they lost Ridley, they bring in Armstead from San Francisco. We've talked about his relationship with Trent Baalke, who drafted him with the 49ers. What did you make of Arik Armstead coming to the Jaguars?
I really like this move quite a bit. I mean, I think there's multiple reasons for it. I mean, we chatted last year a bunch, and by our numbers at PFF and everything I saw on film, it was Josh Allen and friends last year rushing the passer. I mean, Josh Allen was an excellent pass rusher, one of the league's best, and they were not getting any production elsewhere on that defensive line, including from Trayvon Walker. I know Walker's played a lot of snaps, but I don't think he's been a force as a pass rusher, certainly not what they expected at number one overall. So adding Arik Armstead, I think, adds a couple things. First off, a really productive player, guy that can still play, but I love the ability of Armstead to move around the formation. He could play on the interior. He could play on the edge. He's a mismatch creator because of his length and his size, but he's also quick enough to rush off the edge, and he did all of that in San Francisco. And I think that actually helps Trayvon Walker quite a bit because now you have two really difficult, at least from a physical standpoint, two difficult players to match up with. And I know Trayvon Walker's had some success rushing on the interior versus the edge. Now you can mix and match with Allen, with Armstead, with Walker, move those guys around, create mismatches. We see this around the league quite a bit. The Chiefs have done a great job with that, moving Chris Jones, moving some of their length, their longer players, and just creating mismatches on the defensive line. So I think Armstead adds a lot of that flexibility and just a good productive player.
What was your opinion on Trayvon Walker? I thought, you know, amidst the collapse at the end of the year, Steve, losing 5 out of 6 was awful. But to me, Trayvon Walker started to find himself a little bit. I think he had like 8 sacks in the final 8 or 9 games. He got to 10 sacks for the year. I mean, obviously, that's got to be a good sign coming into year number 3.
Yeah, I personally, I don't think it matters all that much, you know, whether he ended up with 10 sacks or 6 sacks. It's you're talking about a handful of plays. I'm not seeing the down-to-down production from a pass rush standpoint. He had a couple good games in there. That's what I think is a bigger indicator, though. It's the pressures. It's the quick pressures, the quick wins. Those are the types of things that are not only impactful for the team, but also better and predictive of, you know, future high sack totals and future big impact plays. So I think Walker still has a ways to go from a pass rush perspective. And to me, I think the sack totals are a little bit of fool's gold because the PFF grade was still at 58, and that is a much more consistent number year to year. PFF pass rush grade is a much better indicator of what's happening in the future rather than sack totals. And I think, you know, that was similar to where Walker was as a rookie. So I think he needs to see a big jump in year 3. A
couple of more for Steve Palazzolo of Pro Football Focus. Steve, on the defensive side, Darius Williams, Rayshon Jenkins, Kalavon Chaisson out, Darnell Savage, Ronald Darby, Trevis Gibson in. Is that a push, in your opinion? Do you have a thought one way or the other there, the guys that left compared to the guys that replaced them?
Yeah, probably a push overall. You know, Ronald Darby's an interesting player. He's been kind of like a rent-a-corner over the last couple of years, but he's a good player. He can still play when he's out there and healthy. Darnell Savage has had some ups and downs at safety. I think overall he's got great potential. Always needed to tidy up his tackling and just be a little bit more consistent. Travis Gibson's definitely an interesting player. Again, just adding some depth there. As a Caleb on Kaysan, you know, just kind of an athletic projection coming out as a first rounder and never productive enough at LSU. And we saw that, never developed. And Gibson is a really, I mean, if you put Travis Gibson now as edge four, basically on that team, that's a good spot to be, or edge four or five competing for that. So that's nice depth. Interesting to see how the secondary ends up working together, but Darby and Savage, I think on paper, are good solid players.
Talking to people in Baltimore, Devin Duvernay, we know about his return capabilities, former All-Pro, former Pro Bowler. Jamal Agnew was very similar here in Jacksonville, but Agnew was a former DB that converted to wide receiver. Duvernay has been a wideout his entire career. So to me, Steve, and I'm curious your thoughts, do they just basically get a younger Agnew that's more capable at wide receiver with Devin Duvernay?
It'd be tough for Duvernay to get the same type of attention that Agnew got. It was like every time he was on the field, you know, they were dialing something up for him, which was, you know, a little boom or bust, but a lot of big plays from Jamal Agnew. I would say Duvernay is a little bit more lateral than Agnew. I think Agnew had that ability to get behind the defense, take it to the house. Again, I know Duvernay had that punt return and everything. A little bit more of an agility type of player, get him some jet sweeps, get the ball in his hands in space, and he can absolutely make plays. So, yeah, I think every offense to me is your wide receivers four and five. You want a jet sweep guy, as I say, and, you know, pretty much a deep threat. And I think Duvernay has a chance to be that jet sweep underneath. You know, lateral agility type of guy. And, you know, he's been a good player for Baltimore.
Jaguars also brought in Joey Sly at kicker and, of course, Mac Jones to back up Trevor Lawrence. Steve, as we begin to wrap up, the Jaguar season ended 2.5 months ago. There's been a lot of change. They've brought in, what, 9 or 10 guys that will be a part of the 53-man roster. I mean, 20% of the roster has already changed, and we haven't even gotten to the draft in late April yet. Are they better than they were January 7th when their season ended, or are they about the same? What's your thought there?
It's funny. All the players that they brought in, I think, you know, I think Armstead is the safest one to predict production from. And then it can go either way for a bunch of the others. But, you know, like Mitch Morris, I think, again, he'll be consistent and solid. But Gabe Davis, a little, you know, boom or bust, high ceiling type of player. So I think overall it's probably a push. And it to me, it feels like Jacksonville, one of those years they have to hit in the draft. And that becomes, we see teams, you know, hit on 2, 3, 4 draft picks, guys who can immediately contribute. If they can do that, especially with Trevor Lawrence getting paid very, very shortly, I think that's just, it's just a huge draft for the Jags. Because I like the guys that they brought in, but have to get that young nucleus built, I think, a little bit better in Jacksonville. So big draft for them. And overall, I'd say, yeah, close to a push, I think, at this point, heading into the draft.
Steve, final question. The South, man, the AFC South was probably the most boring, predictable division in football 12 months ago. All of a sudden, you look now, excitement in Tennessee, bringing in Calvin Ridley, new coaching staff. Jacksonville's doing a lot. Houston with Joe Mixon and Danielle Hunter. Indy kept a lot of their own, but they get Anthony Richardson back. All of a sudden, the AFC South, a lot of intrigue coming into 2024.
Oh, I can't wait to watch the AFC South next year. Absolutely. It's going to be exciting. I mean, got to love what Houston's doing. I mean, I know, other than in Jacksonville.
But
Houston's doing a really nice job, right? You've got the first contract quarterback. They're getting their players in. You know, Danielle Hunter is a D'Amico Ryan's type of defensive lineman. So they're building great depth and taking advantage of the rookie contract quarterback with Stroud. Fascinating moves in Tennessee, a little bit more aggressive, I think, than maybe people expected for a team that felt like they were in transition. And you mentioned with the Colts, with Anthony Richardson coming back, who knows? I mean, he showed a lot of flashes before he got hurt. So if he gets back on track, already made the playoffs last year, Colts look like another tough team. So, yeah, it's going to be pretty fun division this year, I believe.
Steve Palazzolo of PFF. Steve, tell the good folks here in Jacksonville what you have coming out there at PFF.com in the coming days and weeks.
Well, I think the biggest thing is the PFF NFL podcast. We like to go do a lot of mock drafts, like to go team by team, breaking down what's been done and what teams can do. So I would search the PFF NFL podcast wherever you get your podcast.
Steve, I know you're very busy, man. Thank you for making time for us here in Jacksonville. As always, brother, we certainly appreciate it.
Yep, you got it. Appreciate you having me.
There you go. Steve Palazzolo of Pro Football Focus here with us on Hacker After Dark, giving his thoughts on where the Jaguars stand. And I think that's what a lot of national guys think right now. Some uncertainty about Gabe Davis, much like there was with Christian Kirk 2 years ago, right? We think Mitch Morse will be good, but he's 32. We think Eric Armstead will be good, but he's 30. He'll be 31 during the year. Ronald Darby is 30 with some injury problems. He was great in Baltimore. Can he bring that to Jacksonville? So I like the guys they brought in, but if you're looking at it from a national point of view, yeah, there's probably some questions with some of the guys that they brought in during NFL free agency. The draft is 1 month from Monday. Is that right? April 25th, I believe, is the first night of the NFL draft. Wow. So, yeah, we're just over a month away from the festivities up in Detroit. Of course, Jacksonville has the 17th pick, the 49th pick, and three additional picks in the top 117. They got five of the top 117, and they need to hit on those five. One first, one second, one third, and I believe two in round number four. So we'll talk a little draft. Shane Hallam, draft countdown, with a focus on wide receiver and a focus on corner. I think you look at this Jaguar roster right now, at this point I'd be pretty surprised at number 17 if it was not a corner or if it was not a wide receiver. So we'll certainly focus on those two positions coming up with Shane Hallam in just a moment. Updating you on the NCAA tournament, the four games that are ongoing right now. 12 minutes to go in the second half. Texas A&M trying to get the SEC a second team into the round of 32. They're up big on Nebraska, 76-60. Duke up by a touchdown, 42-35 on Vermont, 13 minutes to go. Grambling, hanging around with Purdue, at least right now. That's a 116 in the Midwest. Purdue, 31-27, 3 minutes to go in the first half. Alabama has gone on top of Charleston, 34-26, 5 minutes to go until halftime. And again, there are still four games to go tonight. Longwood in Houston, James Madison, Wisconsin, TCU, Utah State, and Grand Canyon, St. Mary's, all yet to tip off. We will certainly keep you updated. Let's talk draft. Let's talk Jaguars. Let's talk wide receivers and corners. Shane Hallam of DraftCountdown.com is next. Friday night, Hacker After Dark. Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. Boy, the Jaguars had a very active free agent period, bringing in, what, 9 or 10 guys via trade and free agency. And now all eyes begin to turn to the draft, which, believe it or not, is next month. We're about a month away now from the NFL draft up there in Detroit, Michigan. With that, we welcome in Shane Hallam, DraftCountdown.com. He's always kind enough to join us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Shane, how we doing?
I'm doing great. It's like you said, it's getting closer. I'm kind of feeling the draft fever here as we're getting close.
Shane, as a draft guy like you, and you've done it for a long time, and I always tell you how much I love Draft Countdown. I've gone to that website for years. You guys do a phenomenal job with it. As a draft guy, you know, free agency, that obviously has to change a lot of thoughts that you guys have about what certain teams may do. How does free agency change your outlook every year?
Well, it definitely can switch up team needs, right? You know, when a team invests a lot of money into a player multiple years, you know, a big contract, then, you know, you can start to cross off maybe that position from the early rounds, depending on, you know, the team and what happened with that. Or a lot of times when I'm doing mock drafts before free agency, I'm kind of assuming everyone leaves, you know, all the free agents leave and people resign players at the beginning of free agency during it. That changes things. But a lot of times it's kind of a clue to what teams will draft. If they, you know, if they sign a guy to a 1 year deal or a 2 year deal, not a ton of money at a position of need, to me, that's like, that's a position they're looking at, and this isn't a player that they view as a long-term solution, they might use an early draft pick on that. So I think sometimes people say, oh, they signed a D lineman, or they signed a center, or they signed a corner, so they're not going to draft that. A lot of times it's the opposite. They sign those players, it's not a big deal. That is a position they're going to target in the draft.
Shane Hallam of Draft Countdown. When you look at Jacksonville, Shane, you and I were talking earlier, very active for the Jaguars. They brought in a lot of guys. They certainly lost some guys as well, including Calvin Ridley. But when you look at everything that transpired, anything catch you off guard as to what Jacksonville did during free agency?
I thought it was a good period for them. I mean, I think they made some smart deals. I was a little surprised the Mitch Morse bringing him in at center. You know, last time you and I talked, that was a position we talked about a lot. And it was a two-year deal. I think they still could invest in center in the draft a little bit. But that was a little bit surprising to me. I thought they might wait and grab a rookie there. But I like what they did in the secondary as well. You know, Ronald Darby, I think, is a good investment at the cornerback position. I was surprised maybe that they were as active as they were. I thought maybe Jacksonville would sit back a little bit. But, it's kind of nice that they didn't. I think they've rounded out some of the rough edges of the team.
Calvin Ridley is gone. Gabe Davis is here. And the crazy thing about Gabe Davis, he's not even 25 years old yet. He turns 25 next month, 27 career touchdowns at Buffalo. I'm just curious, going back a couple of years to when he was at UCF, what did you think of Gabe Davis then, and what do you think of him now on his way to Jacksonville?
My opinions of Gabe Davis have been a roller coaster. I think I was a big fan of his coming out into the draft. I love the deep speed. I thought he was so good at tracking the football, fighting with corners. Like, there's a lot of good things to like coming out of UCF, but it was UCF, and sometimes those players don't work out. And he had some real early success with Buffalo, not just as a deep threat. We saw in the playoffs a couple years back in the red zone, they utilized him a lot. We've kind of seen the last 2 years of him fall off a little bit from that. So to me, I think you're getting a guy that can stretch the field, which I think Jacksonville desperately needed. We're trying to kind of fit square pegs into round holes last year to get a receiver to really stretch the field and get down the field quickly for the big play and keep the safeties back. But I think you have someone that has some untapped potential. He still has not hit his peak, and maybe that's to come.
If we assume that Zay Jones is going to be here, Shane, that would mean – Zay Jones, Christian Kirk, and Gabe Davis. Do you still feel with those three that wide receiver could potentially be in play for Jacksonville at 17?
I think it could. And, you know, like, if we assume that Zay Jones is sticking around and going to keep his prominent role, then maybe at 17, you don't lean that way unless a player falls. I think you would need one of the top four wide receivers in this draft to really take someone there. So if those three stick around, I would probably look more day two. You're bringing in a player who can maybe come in, be the wide receiver four, and eventually develop to take over that Zay Jones role potentially in a year. I think 17, you'll see a lot of mock drafts with receivers of 17 to Jacksonville. Just Calvin Ridley's gone. Let's plug a receiver here. I think it's going to be very difficult, and I honestly don't know if the value will be there for the Jaguars at 17 with receiver anyway.
Shane Hallam, DraftCountdown.com. Shane, the two receivers that at least the fans are talking most about here, Mitchell from Texas, Thomas from LSU. What's your thought on both guys?
Both are raw. I mean, both have some warts that need to work. Brian Thomas Jr. from LSU, I think, is the better player. I think if he is there at 17, it's really tempting to take someone like Thomas, who has the size, has the 4.3 speed. And what we saw with him at LSU is, he's an elite red zone threat as well. He's who Jaden Daniels looked for when they got close to the end zone. Just the way he can contort his body and catch the football, it makes him such an intriguing receiver. So I think Thomas could be worth that high of a pick. Adonai Mitchell checks the boxes. You know, you see the size, you see the athleticism we saw at the combine. I think there's a lot to like about him, but man, you pop on the film and he just disappears for stretches. I don't know. He gives up on plays. Just I don't know if it was a situation of the offense and kind of what they asked him to do, or if it was an effort issue. But, you know, I worry if he really is as polished as the stats and athleticism indicate. I wouldn't touch him at 17. I think maybe late in the first round, late 20s, early 30s, I'd be comfortable, but he could go earlier than that.
You look at the defensive back spot. You mentioned the Jaguars brought in Ronald Darby. They released Darius Williams. They have Tyson Campbell, but clearly Campbell and Darby, and there's a drop-off after that to Gregory Jr. and Monteric Brown. So to me, Shane, it still appears defensive back is a need, and it's good that it's a need because obviously it's a very deep class. At 17, a lot of talk that Quinyon Mitchell will be gone. Terrion Arnold of Alabama likely to be gone. We've seen Cooper DeJean at Iowa mock to Jacksonville. What's your thought about the corners that could be there at 17?
I have a seven-round mock draft coming out on Monday. I'm going to have Jacksonville taking a corner at 17. I'm still deciding which one because there are a number that I think will be available. I'm with you. I think Mitchell and Arnold are probably gone by that point, but the rest of the corners could be there. I like Cooper DeJean. I think he's a strong possibility as an outside corner. He could play a little bit of safety as well if you need him to. A good cover guy, has that athleticism and speed. I think Nate Wiggins from Clemson could be a really nice fit because he can play in the nickel but has that speed for the outside. You can move him around, even have him shadow specific receivers. I think Wiggins would be a good fit because of that versatility and probably, you know, looking for someone to play a little bit of nickel back. So I think that would be an ideal fit for Jacksonville. Those are probably the two main players on my mind right now. I think we've had some guys fall off, like Kamari Lassiter from Georgia, who, you know, if we look, start looking at day two, then maybe he's someone that could fall into Jacksonville's lap if they don't go corner in round one.
Shane Hallam, Draft Countdown with us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. You look at the offensive line now, bringing in Mitch Morse, maybe not necessarily a need there. They re-signed Ezra Cleveland as well. But the interesting thing about this roster, Shane, is next year, the only offensive tackle that'll be under contract is Anton Harrison. Cam Robinson scheduled to be a free agent after the 24 season. Walker Little scheduled to be a free agent after the 24 season. I'm not saying draft a tackle necessarily at 17, but like you said at the beginning here, you got to look at these contracts and the links, and clearly with Little and Robinson both due for extensions after 24, offensive tackle is something that might be in the back of the mind for Trent Baalke in round two or certainly round three.
I think it's a strong possibility that you could draft a left tackle. You see how they develop, and if you feel good about it, hey, you can kind of let everyone go. I think there's going to be some tackles that fall in this draft just based on the depth of the position, and a lot of teams, you know, spent in free agency, brought in some tackles. I think you could look at a guy like Patrick Paul from Houston, who's just a mammoth. Huge arms, huge size, lots of potential, especially when you have this luxury maybe to sit this left tackle for a year. I think, I mean, take a toolsy guy like Patrick Paul in round two, round three, and you could really build onto that and see if you have something there. So, yeah, you know, I think tackle is going to be now higher on that priority list. And honestly, looking at the Jaguars' needs, it feels like a really safe day two selection there.
Shane, when you look at the league as a whole and the draft class as a whole, guys that have risen the most maybe in the last 2 months, say from the Senior Bowl to now, who is really coming up the board?
You know, we talked about Quinyon Mitchell from Toledo. I mean, I think he put on an excellent Senior Bowl week in performance, one of the best corners that I've ever seen down there in my decade plus going down to Mobile. Then you add in the combine measurements that were outstanding for him. I think he's made himself, you know, a ton of money in that way. The receiver position, I think there have been a lot of players. Ladd McConkey, the receiver from Georgia, is a player who, you know, people were thought maybe he could get into day two. And then he has an excellent Senior Bowl performance, just gets open on every rep, much faster at the combine than I think people expected to go with his acceleration, can play slot, can play outside. Now he's getting pushed up. Some people even have him in round one at the end. Maybe Kansas City has shown a lot of interest in Ladd McConkey. So, you know, he's definitely risen up boards. And then some of the interior linemen that you and I have talked about in the past, Jackson Powers Johnson, the center from Oregon. I think he did well both those performances. So it more players hurt them, you know, help themselves than hurt themselves in this kind of January, February, March area. And you see guys get pushed up.
Well, that's where I was going next. And in the same token, guys that have fallen since maybe the Senior Bowl. Is there anybody in free fall right now?
One corner that I think this whole year has been a little bit of a free fall, but it's really hit the past 2 months, is Kalen King from Penn State. If you go back and look at mock drafts from the summer or the college season, you'll see him in the first round, and now he's not sniffing the top 100. Thought he was going to be very athletic, wasn't that athletic at the combine, had a really poor Senior Bowl performance, and he might end up, you know, not even being the first Penn State corner selected, let alone being a top pick. So he's definitely hurt himself. And the Miami Hurricanes have just had a rough couple months. Cameron Kinchins, the safety there, a lot of people had him as the top safety in the draft, had basically a 38 percentile athleticism from the combine, which is awful for a top safety. You know, maybe he can still be a top 100 pick, round three pick. But, you know, that's hurting. Then James Williams, their other safety, was a five-star recruit, also had a poor combine performance. So I'm not sure what happened with the Miami players, but it wasn't a great day in Indianapolis for them.
Shane Hallam, Draft Countdown. Before we get to the website, Shane, I want you to tell folks here in Jacksonville what you guys have coming out. It's basically getting to the end of March, right? We're on the doorstep of the end of March. We're, what, about 5.5 weeks away, roughly, from the NFL draft. If teams needed to draft now, do you think they could? Do they have all the information they need, or is there still a couple of weeks of work left to go?
I think we still have some pieces. I think you could probably make most of the selections in the first 2 days, but a lot of the day three information, pro days, seeing the athleticism, some players that didn't get combine invites, teams are starting to start their official visits, which is important for some teams that really, you know, hone in on that, bring in the players they want to draft. So I think they're close, but a little more information's needed. I think probably in 2 or 3 weeks, most teams' boards are going to be pretty well organized.
Shane, tell the good folks here in Jacksonville about Draft Countdown. You mentioned your 7-round mock draft that's coming out next Monday. What can people expect when they head on over to the website?
Yeah, you can check out the mock drafts. We have rankings. You can look at my rankings. I have a big board, 350 players long, as well as positional rankings. You can check out our podcast, the Draft Countdown podcast. We do every week and get deep into the weeds here. And I think in a couple of weeks here, we're going to actually have a Jacksonville only mock draft for the site. So be sure to check back and check that out.
No, love that. We'll have you on when that drops. No question about it. Shane Hallam, draftcountdown.com. He's certainly one of our guys when it comes to the draft here on 1010XL. Shane, as always, man, appreciate it. Know you're busy. We'll talk again soon.
No, thanks so much.
After Dark on 1010XL.
Really appreciate all those of you on the text line tonight telling me how it just means more in the SEC that they're 1-5. Did I not literally start the show giving the SEC grief about 1-5? Yes, I'm very much aware of the slogan that they use. And hey, kick a guy while he's down, kick a conference while he's down. It's all fine and well. There's not much defense for it. It's been bad for the Southeastern Conference, although it looks like A&M's going to win and Alabama is leading Charleston, so maybe they'll at least get three into the round of 32. The Orlando Magic in the NBA are currently the 4 seed in the Eastern Conference. They would have home court in round one against the New York Knicks if the playoffs started right now. They've won 5 in a row. They're 18-5, I believe, in their last 23. One of the hottest teams in the NBA. We'll talk NBA, Zach Hanschu of Roto World, and spring football underway for Florida State. We'll go over to Tallahassee. Kurt Weiler of the Osceola covering Florida State athletics. All that to come in the 9 o'clock hour on a Friday night edition of Hacker After Dark. Let's talk NBA. Zach Hanschu of Roto World is next on 1010XL and 92.5 FM. Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. The National Basketball Association's regular season is winding down. Most teams have less than 15 games remaining in the regular season. The playoff picture is beginning to take shape, although there are some battles on both the West and Eastern side, and the Orlando Magic have officially clinched a playoff spot, kinda. They're officially at least in the play-in tournament. With all that being said, Zach Hanchu of Roto World covering the NBA. He's one of our guys here on 1010XL, and he's always kind enough to join us here in the city of Jacksonville. Zach, how you doing?
I am doing great, brother. How about yourself?
Zach, we're good. As a long-suffering Orlando Magic fan, look, we have more bigger aspirations, but officially in at least the play-in tournament after the victory over Charlotte earlier this week. And, Zach, your thoughts. You and I haven't talked in a few weeks. Orlando, 12-3 since the All-Star break, one of the hottest teams in the league right now.
Yeah, man. I knew they had been great since the All-Star break, but I had to pull up the numbers here just to wrap my head around it. So, third best record since the break. They've allowed the second fewest points, just over 100 per game, best defensive rating in basketball, and the fifth best point differential. So these guys are rolling right now. I know we had talked earlier in the season that their schedule was kind of backloaded. So you get through that first part of the season, you make it to the break, your schedule kind of lightens up a little bit down the stretch. But 12-3, that's no easy feat for any team. I mean, the NBA has just been full of surprises this season. Teams coming out to play every night. There's, you know, so much parity. So for them to be going 12-3 right now, they're rolling at the right time. As you mentioned, they've at least clinched a spot within the top 10. They're clinging right now to the number 5 seed. But man, they're 3.5 games out of the 2 seed. Like, this is not just them sneaking in here. They're in contention to be one of the best seeds here in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, they've battled. There's no question about it. And the thing, Zach, to me is, look, I want to get to the players in a moment, but your thoughts on Jamal Mosley, man, a brand new contract extension. I'm not sure, Zach, nationally or even regionally, if he maybe gets the credit that he's probably due.
I don't think he or the players get the credit. You know, the Orlando Magic are not they're not a team that's widely covered. They're not a team that's widely talked about. But what they're doing right now is, with Mosley, with them extending him out, they're building this core and this structure for years to come. They have the young players. They have the coach. Obviously, the players are buying in to what Mosley is doing and teaching down there. So, yeah, this is a team that deserves far more credit and coverage than what they're getting.
Zach Hanchu of Roto World. Zach, do you think, look, the diehards do. I mean, guys that cover it, you and I do. But the average sports fan, the average everyday NBA fan, do you think they're aware of how good Banchero and Franz Wagner are in Orlando?
I don't think anybody's aware of that, right? So we have Banchero, obviously reigning rookie of the year. Nobody's really talking about him because, as we, you know, as we just said, Orlando's not getting coverage, and now you have the new flashy guys in Wemby and Chet who are vying for Rookie of the Year this year. But something that I thought was interesting, if you pull up Banchero's stats, 22.7 points, 6.7 rebounds, 5.3 assists, 1 steal, 1.5 triples per game. Those are his averages in year two. Only players in NBA history to average at least those stats within their first two seasons, he and Luka Doncic. And we see what Luka is doing right now, averaging, you know, 35, 9, and 9. So it's the trajectory for Banchero, if he continues doing what he's doing, it's just out of this world.
You know, we always talk about the big threes, Zach, right? You go back to LeBron and Wade and Bosch, and there's been a lot of big threes over the years. Orlando seems like they're growing one in-house, right? Banchero and Franz Wagner. And then all of a sudden, here comes Jalen Suggs. And Jalen Suggs, the first 2 years, people were wondering, you know, was he worth a top 5 pick? He wasn't great. He had some great moments, but he had struggled. Boy, Jalen Suggs, Zach, I don't know your thoughts, man, but to me, he has really come on. He has proven he's worth that top 5 pick, and he is joining Banchero and Wagner as an unbelievable nucleus down there in Central Florida.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think NBA fans, often can kind of gravitate more towards guys that scored a high volume. So you're not going to look at a guy like Jalen Suggs averaging, 11, 12 points a game. But the guy on defense is just ridiculous. And he's an underrated playmaker as well. Even though he doesn't have, quite the same opportunities to facilitate as maybe a Banchero, a Wagner, or even a Markelle Fultz when he's available. But Jalen Suggs on both ends of the court, I think you're absolutely right, is living up to that top five selection.
Last thought on Orlando, and then we'll branch out to the Eastern Conference. I was watching that game against Charlotte the other night. And look, everybody talks about Banchero, Wagner, and Suggs, right, if you're an Orlando fan. And then you got Gary Harris and Wendell Carter. But, man, that bench, right? Joe Ingles, Jonathan Isaac, Cole Anthony, Markelle Fultz, Mo Wagner, Anthony Black, Goga Bitadze. And maybe I'm a magic homer here, Zach. You cover it on a national basis. I mean, you go 1 to 10 or even 1 to 12 on a roster, Orlando might be as deep as any team in the league.
No, I absolutely agree with you here. I don't think this is being a magic homer. I mean, when you have the luxury of playing a Jonathan Isaac fewer than 10 minutes a game and just saying, hey, come out here, make a couple defensive stops, maybe get a couple buckets for us. You got an Anthony Black who you're given time to develop. You don't necessarily need to throw him into the fire all the time. And then you have veterans like a Joe Ingles, and you have microwave scorers. You have Mo Wagner, who is very underrated as a scorer, and you have Cole Anthony, who can heat up and give you 30 on any given night when he's really feeling it. So, and Markelle Fultz, former number one pick, obviously injury prone. A lot of people have kind of written him off. But when you have the luxury of bringing him off the bench for 15, 20 minutes a night, and just giving you a little bit without that injury risk, this is a dangerous team.
No question about it. Zach Hanchu of Roto World. And let's talk about the teams they're competing with. It is a logjam in the East, although Orlando beginning to separate a little bit. There were like a game and a half separating five teams. And now Miami and Indiana and Philadelphia, I believe, are all at least 2.5 back of Orlando at the time you and I are speaking. But New York, Orlando, Philly, Miami, Indy, what's your thought on those five teams in the middle of the Eastern Conference?
Yeah, so I think New York is obviously going to be the biggest threat here. Indiana, I think, can potentially pick it back up, but they're really going to need a bounce back here from Tyrese Halliburton. He's really, really struggled since the All-Star break, and the team has definitely been feeling that. I think Miami, same thing. They've just been dealing with so many injuries up and down the roster, and it's not a talented roster. To begin with, obviously they lost some guys after last year's finals run. In Chicago, you and I have talked at length about Chicago. It's a disappointment waiting to happen every single night. So I think New York is going to be the biggest threat, but they're dealing with plenty of injuries themselves. So I think out of this group here, and even looking up the standings, right, Giannis is banged up. The two seed Milwaukee, Donovan Mitchell is going to miss some time with that nasal fracture. So Orlando is really looking like the healthiest bunch here, and they're the youngest bunch as well.
Does anybody, Orlando aside, does anybody in the East Sac challenge Boston, or, are they going to run away with this thing in the Eastern Conference playoffs?
I'll tell you what, man, as long as Boston is healthy, because I don't trust their bench, they do not have as deep a bench as Orlando or many of these other teams out here. But their starting five is just ridiculous. So as long as those guys are healthy for the playoff run, I think the East is theirs to lose, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it would be a big disappointment if Boston did not at least get to the NBA Finals. Zach Hanchu of Roto World. Zach, in the time we have left, let's head out west. All right, so Minnesota, Oklahoma City, still very good. I think Denver is starting to come on, obviously, as the defending champion. The Clippers have been surprisingly good, I guess, with the arrival of James Harden. I mean, what's your thought there at the top of the Western Conference?
Yeah, I think, obviously, we're kind of bunched up here at the top of the West. We have OKC, Denver, and Minnesota all vying for that top seed, and all three of them could certainly get there. But with the way Denver's playing right now, at this point, I think the playoff race in the West is theirs to lose. Just because they have the playoff experience, they have the title, they have presumably this year's MVP, unless something drastic here changes over the next few weeks. And Oklahoma City, as great as they've been this year, I don't know that they or anybody else out West can compete with Denver in a seven-game series. Denver is so physical. Denver is smart. Denver makes the right plays. They have shooters. They have defense. And they just have size over everybody. So I don't see a team, whether it be the Clippers, Thunder, or Timberwolves, competing with them in seven games.
The absolute crazy thing for everybody except Denver, for Minnesota and Oklahoma City in particular, you fight, you scratch, you claw for 82 games, right, to get the highest seed you can, to think maybe you'll have an easier opponent in round one. But one of those teams is going to draw the Lakers, right? The other team might draw Dallas or Phoenix. Or it's crazy, the West, and how it's going to shake out once we figure out 1 through 8 after the play-in tournament.
Oh, I mean, 100%. The Eastern Conference playoffs, I don't see, unfortunately, being very exciting. The Western Conference, though, as you mentioned, this might be the greatest play-in tournament. Play-in tournament might be better than some of the regular season, or, you know, some of the regular playoff games we're getting out East. We got Dallas, Phoenix, Lakers, Warriors, and actually Houston's just a couple games back of Golden State. I'm not sure if they'll catch them, but that's at least something to keep an eye on. But, yeah, as you mentioned, man, these guys, whoever comes out of this play-in tournament, we're going to get OKC and Lakers. We're going to get Denver and Phoenix. We're going to maybe get Golden State and Minnesota. I mean, some of these matchups are just going to be phenomenal.
Can the Lakers do anything in the postseason, or are they just too old, too injury-prone right now?
You know, I hate to be that guy that just keeps throwing out that same saying, but when you have LeBron James and Anthony Davis healthy, you can't count the Lakers out. And I think that is true again this year.
All right, Zach, final thought. Again, Zach Hanchu of Roto World. Final thought. We'll have you on hopefully before the playoffs begin. But as we sit right now, end of March, as we're about a week and a half out from the beginning of April, is it as simple as Denver and Boston for you? Or could one of those teams, particularly Denver, have more issues in the playoffs?
Yeah, I think they both could have issues. To me, I think it's a done deal out East, but we've seen Boston kind of disappoint in some big spots. We've seen Jason Tatum kind of not come through in the fourth quarter sometimes. So I think, and health-wise, with a Kristaps Porzingis potentially, he ends up getting injured. But otherwise, I think it's a done deal in the East. Denver, though. Oklahoma City could surprise you. I think they have a puncher's chance when you have that young of a team and you have an MVP candidate in SGA as well. And Minnesota with their defense this year, Karl Anthony Towns can come back for the playoffs. They might have the size to compete with Denver, and that could cause some problems.
Zach, tell the good folks here in Jacksonville that are big NBA fans like myself about Roto World and the coverage you guys provide over there.
Yeah, man. Over at Roto World, we're covering NBA games, NBA injury notes, game recaps, just projecting out for the playoffs. We're doing all of that kind of stuff on a daily basis. We got guys working all morning, all evening, just keeping up with the latest news and notes from around the association.
Zach Hanchu of Roto World covering the NBA. He's certainly one of our guys here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Zach, I know you're busy. Thank you as always, brother, for the time. We'll do it again right before the playoffs.
Appreciate it, man. Good talking to you.
Back here on 1010XL and 92.5 FM in the city of Jacksonville, we are glad you are with us. Over in Tallahassee, boy, the baseball team's off to one of their best starts ever. The basketball team is trying to pick up the pieces of what was an unfortunate season. What is the future of Leonard Hamilton over in the state capitol? And the football team under Mike Norvell with his brand new contract starts spring football this week. There's a lot to get into with that. One of our guys over in Tallahassee is Kurt Weiler of the Osceola, and he's always kind enough to join us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Kurt, how you doing?
I am doing good, Ryan. I appreciate you always having me on.
Hey, Kurt, thank you for the time as always. All right, another year, a brand new contract for Mike Norvell, spring football underway this week. Just an early outlook. What's your thought on the 2024 Florida State Seminoles as spring ball kicks off?
Yeah, it's a fascinating team with losing so many pieces. Obviously, April going to be a busy month for Florida State in terms of, I mean, a lot of guys going to hear their names called in the NFL draft. I think 12 guys off last year's team were at the combine, and a bunch of them should be drafted. But it'll be an interesting year, too, with so many new faces and important faces around the Florida State football program. I think they already have – they already have upwards of 25 newcomers on campus as early enrollees, either transfers or freshmen. So a lot of new faces and a lot of people going to be asked to take on pretty significant roles immediately.
Life after Jordan Travis officially begins. DJU back in the ACC after a one-year stint there in Corvallis, Oregon. What is the thought on DJ Uiagalelei coming into Tallahassee here?
Praise from Mike Norvell yesterday, and we talked to Tony Tokars as well about how well he's kind of Mike talked to how he's earned the respect of his teammates. That's probably not surprising. I mean, I think it helps for DJ. There are a lot of new faces and a lot of guys stepping into bigger roles where this isn't a team where he was kind of the missing piece, I would say. But I think it makes sense with his experience, with the production he's had in college football, that I think he's done a great job behind the scenes of doing those things. And I'm interested to see how it translates now. I thought he made some really nice steps last year at Oregon State. And I think it's also of note that he was 245 pounds when he got here. He's 6'4", 245, a big guy. He's added 10 more pounds. He's now 255 pounds. So it definitely feels like they are trying to bulk him up to make him durable, to make him a real asset in the run game. And that's something he can do at his size for sure.
Kurt Weiler of the Osceola covering Florida State with us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Kurt, the skill position guys, they got to replace a lot, including Keon Coleman and Johnny Wilson. What does it look like at the wide receiver position heading into the spring?
Yeah, the wide receiver position's definitely, I would say, maybe the most interesting on the offensive side of the ball, just because they are replacing a lot of production. I mean, Keon and Johnny, when they were healthy, played a lot of the snaps last year. I think both went in games they played, both played like 70% or more of the team snaps. It was a lot. They when you have two guys like that, you rely on them pretty heavily. And Florida State has a lot of candidates, and it's fascinating to see for sure how that's going to break down. I think, I mean, they brought in two transfers. Malik Benson from Alabama was the number one JUCO player in the country before he went to Alabama last year. And I think the early buzz about him has been very strong. Similarly, Jaylen Brown from LSU. But they have a lot of guys returning too. I mean, the sophomores last year, I think Destin Hill and Hakeem Williams both played a good bit last year as freshmen before suffering injuries that kind of limited them a bit down the stretch. And I think especially Hakeem, I mean, he was a five-star recruit. I think he's a guy who a lot of people are pegging as a potential breakout. I think guys like, I mean, they have Kentron Portier and Ja'Kai Douglas, who've both been around the program for a long time and are still, I mean, have been content to wait their turn. And this feels like a chance for this to be their turn. It's fascinating because it feels like there are plenty of viable candidates. They're not at a loss for guys who could become that guy, but this spring will be fascinating to see who takes advantage of that and who really rises to the occasion, because it's hard for me to pick. There are so many candidates.
The running back position looks pretty good. Now, I know they had some losses there, but Toa Feely's back. Roydell Williams, right, comes in from Alabama. How are they feeling about the tailback position right now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for how important Trey Benson was to them the last few years, I think they do feel very good. I know Roydell's been somebody who's been praised for how immediately he's taken on a leadership role in the offense. It just seems like that's something that comes naturally to him. And yeah, Lawrence Toafili is now in year five and has played a lot of football at Florida State. I mean, since a true freshman, he's really had a role every year on this team. And then honestly, I'll say, I mean, because Kaziah Holmes is a guy not to be lost in there. He was a Penn State transfer who kind of carved out a role for himself last year deeper in the rotation, and that may increase. And I'm also high on I think maybe the freshman who I think is going to make the most immediate impact is Cam Davis. I mean, he is a physical specimen, was a high school quarterback, but effective running the ball as well. And I think could very well break into their rotation right away as a true freshman this year.
Kurt Weiler of the Osceola with us here on 1010XL in Jacksonville. Kurt, the defensive side of the ball, obviously you got to replace a lot from Jared Verse to Jones and, Green in the secondary. We see what, you know, Fisk is doing in the pre-draft situation, what he did at the combine. Obviously, a lot of really good players on defense that have to be replaced. What is the thought about the Florida State defense heading into the year?
Yeah, I think the thought is it's always tough when you lose that much production really at every level. I mean, you lose a really effective or two effective defensive tackles. I mean, an all-ACC defensive end, two starting linebackers, and three defensive backs who played a lot of football at Florida State. But I feel like that, even more than the offense, is really where the homegrown has been really strong for. I mean, the development. I mean, I know some people talk. I see some talk from rival fans about how there's been no development from players under Mike Norvell. It's been all portal. And I think the defense especially really speaks to how wrong that is, because you look at, I mean, Pat Payton in the year he had now as a defensive end, and he started last year. He started the last 2 years, really, and I think looks ready to take that next step. And what they've built at Josh Farmer at defensive tackle, I think what they've built with a guy like Shaheem Brown at safety and some other guys like Azaria Thomas at cornerback, they have guys. I mean, they're losing a lot, but they have guys who played a good amount of football in each of those spots, and they really supplemented well through the portal, bringing in three defensive ends, bringing in a defensive tackle, bringing in a linebacker, bringing in a defensive back, or two defensive backs, actually. I think it'd be interesting to see how that sorts itself out, because they are losing a lot, but like at receiver, I think at quite a few of those spots, they have options. And so it's about how that pecking order gets sorted out this spring.
There's a lot of untapped potential, it sounds like, Kurt, from what you're saying. Now, look, the reality is they did lose a lot of contributors off a very good football team, and a football team that, to me, deserved to be in the playoff last year. We all remember how that went down. What is the expectation in 24, knowing there's a lot of good young talent, but maybe unproven as compared to what they had a year ago?
I mean, especially now that we're in the 12-team playoff era, where the ACC champ is, I have to imagine, always going to get in, I think that there is a thought that should be the expectation. I mean, I think you don't want to fall too far below like 9-ish wins, because I think if you start dipping from what 13-1 or 13-0 at the time of the snub to 8-4 or so, you start to wonder, you don't want to overreact, but you start to question, you know, was that just the circumstances of how that season came together a bit. So I think, I think 9 wins or more with the experience they added, they're definitely, I mean, with what they added through the portal, I think it definitely feels like there is an emphasis on we need to keep this momentum going at least a little. I mean, you can't expect the same as last year. You can't expect that every year. But I think Florida State believes, and I think a lot of people believe, they should be in the conversation for the ACC's playoff spot, if not the team that they win another ACC title and get there.
Mike Norvell, final four football thought, Kurt. Mike Norvell, the brand new extension this offseason. He's now one of the highest paid coaches in college football. I imagine he's very excited about having that behind him and ready to move on there in Tallahassee.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was going to get the raise anyways, but then obviously the Nick Saban retirement and all, and him being a name pretty heavily tied in that search, I think only accelerated the timeline for getting that raise done on Florida State. And I mean, obviously, I think it's big for Mike Norvell, no doubt. I mean, he has proven he is probably about as adept as anyone at adapting to this new age of college football. I don't think anyone's really rebuilt a program to the level he has using the portal so heavily, and their incredible hit rate on the portal seems notable. I think it's even a bigger deal for Florida State because, I mean, with the snub, with how Mike Norvell has built the program back, I mean, if they had lost him, that would have been a real blow that I feel like would have really tested a lot of people in the fan base of just like real adversity on top of adversity. And it would have been like, you start feeling like, to throw that back biblical, I think you start feeling like Job at a certain point of just like, I guess nothing's going to go right here. But it's a big deal for all around, for sure.
Final moments with Kurt Weiler of the Osceola. All right, to basketball. As spring football begins, basketball season comes to an end. Obviously a disappointing season, not what they wanted, but Leonard Hamilton, mid-70s, Kurt, we seem to have this conversation every year. Do we know yet what the future holds for Leonard Hamilton there in Tallahassee?
We do not definitively. I mean, the problem with how college basketball is, I mean, it's even crazier, I think, for teams in the tournament. The transfer portal opened on Monday. Like, the day after Selection Sunday, the portal is open. So, obviously, for a team like Florida State that didn't get in the NIT either. They were kind of on that bubble, and their season's over. I think obviously you start looking at stuff like that. There's been nothing definitive on the future. There's been no announcement or kind of reporting yet one for sure either way. He has 1 year left on the contract. And I think when you're looking at the Florida State side of things, when they're building a football facility, when they're renovating Doak Campbell Stadium, when they're in a lawsuit with the ACC, I wonder if they are willing to buy out 1 year of a contract or want to commit money there as else. I mean, you're buying out him and his staff, and then you're paying more for a new coach, because I can't imagine you're getting a new coach you would want with what you're paying Leonard Hamilton, which isn't much over $2 million annually. So I think if I'm Florida State, I announce a farewell tour of sorts. And I don't think Leonard Hamilton especially is the type who wants that attention, but I think you're past the point of what he wants. I think for your own good, you have to say, and I think that frees up a coaching search to begin earlier. Like, you don't have to wait until the end of the season next year. You can maybe start having those conversations earlier and get somebody lined up quicker, because that's no doubt the MO in college basketball nowadays is moving fast.
You know, Mike Martin, obviously revered over there. Bobby Bowden, need I say more? I mean, Leonard Hamilton, probably not on that tier. But the guy's been there almost a quarter century, right? I mean, almost 25 years. I mean, what is the legacy that he's left with that basketball program if he has, you know, a year or less remaining there?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sad ending. The last few years, I mean, whenever it ends, however it ends, it's hard to envision it getting back to what it was in his time here at this point with how it's fallen off over the last few years. But I think that shouldn't definitely diminish what he has accomplished. I mean, Florida State had stretches. They made a national championship game and lost to UCLA back in the 70s. They lost to Bill Walton, but not a program that's had historical success by any means. I mean, a program that definitely has had spurts, but never, I mean, he has had multiple stretches about as good as any in Florida State basketball history. I'm not sure anybody would have envisioned that Florida State would have won an ACC regular season title. I mean, winning a tournament's one thing. We just saw NC State do that. You can get hot. But winning the regular season speaks to you are the best team day in and day out. And Florida State did that in the 2020 season. That, I mean, I'm convinced that would have been Leonard Hamilton's Final Four team. He hasn't gotten, and it got taken away by the pandemic. And it's, I mean, that's part of it too, is it comes into the what could have been, because I really do think that team would have been a Final Four team. And once you get there, who knows what can happen. But he's done incredible things. I've talked about, I think his name eventually should be on the court. I don't think he'll go for that while he's here, but I think you should put his name on the court. He has accomplished that level of success at a place like Florida State.
Kurt, final question. Florida State baseball, obviously an incredible start to the year, one of the best teams in the country. Link Jarrett, I guess there were maybe some questions about him after last year. Those questions have completely and totally gone away. I mean, what's the level of excitement around the baseball program with what they're doing right now?
It is very high. I mean, I think it was spring break last weekend, so like a lot of the students who might supplement that baseball attendance, especially in the bleachers way down the sidelines, weren't in town, a lot of them, but it was still, I mean, packed and active. The buy-in is real. I think there is a sense of sigh of relief of, I mean, I'm not going to say I ever lost the faith, but I know there were some bad circumstances, and Lincoln Jarrett didn't inherit a good situation. And the run he made with Notre Dame to Omaha kind of delayed his timeline for how he could fix things. I think affected how much he could rebuild the roster in year one. And I think that showed on the field. Obviously they missed the NCAA tournament for the first time since 1977. But it's been everything you thought you were getting in a Link Jarrett team. I mean, they field at an incredible level. They're on pace for the best fielding percentage in program history. They hit well. They run the bases. They're just a smart team. I mean, they don't beat themselves. It's I thought they'd be better. You would not have thought they'd be 18-0. Not sure I would have thought they would have gone and put up 12 runs on Florida. They'll play there, obviously, next week in your neck of the woods in Jacksonville again. But it's been impressive. I didn't think it would I thought Link could get the program to a level like this. I did not think it would happen this fast, especially after seeing how last year happened.
Kurt, tell the good folks here in Jacksonville about the Osceola and what they can expect when they head on over to the website.
Yeah, we're recording this Tuesday morning. I'm getting ready to go out in a few hours for the first football practice of spring. We get to watch, I mean, entire practices for the spring. So I think we get some really great insight that we can provide on our boards. We have observations off of every practice. Spring feels like a great time to dive into those because you don't have games you have to worry about. So I think it's just a lot of who's standing out, and obviously great baseball coverage, basketball, as we find out really what the situation is there, and recruiting. It's always going on over there as well on TheOsceola.com or FloridaState.Rivals.com.
Kurt Weiler is one of our guys over in Tallahassee with the Osceola, and he's always kind enough to give us some time here on 1010XL. Kurt, appreciate it, my man. We'll do it again right around the spring game. We'll see where things are at that point.
Sounds great.
And thank you to Kurt Weiler of the Osceola over in Tallahassee for coming on tonight to talk a little Florida State spring football as the Seminoles and head coach Mike Norvell, he with his brand new contract extension this offseason, are on the field for spring practice. Also spent a little time talking about Leonard Hamilton and his future in Tallahassee. The guy's been there almost a quarter century, if you can believe that, in Tallahassee as the basketball coach, and the absolutely ridiculous start that the baseball team is on there with Link Jarrett in year number two for him over there with the Florida State Seminoles. Well, that'll just about do it. It has been a very, very busy Friday evening and a very busy week here on Hacker After Dark. We certainly appreciate you guys for hanging out with us all week long here on 1010XL and on 92.5 FM. We got a lot of people to thank tonight. Again, Kurt Weiler of the Osceola, that's the Rivals website covering Florida State athletics. Thank you to Zach Hanchu of Roto World, talking a little NBA. The Orlando Magic, one of the hottest teams in the NBA. What are they now, 13-3, I believe, since the All-Star break. They currently sit in the four spot in the Eastern Conference. If the Eastern Conference playoffs began today, Orlando would have home court in round number one, taking on the New York Knicks. What a turnaround for the Orlando Magic, led by Paolo Banchero, Franz Wagner, and Jalen Suggs. I'm telling you guys, it's a lot of fun down in Central Florida. It's only about an hour and 45-minute drive. You should go down and catch a Magic game, if not this year, certainly next year, because that is a team on the rise in the NBA Eastern Conference. Thank you to Shane Hallam of Draft Countdown back in hour number one for stopping by. Now that free agency is mostly in the rearview mirror, we can take a deep dive into what the Jaguars could potentially do in late April. And certainly looking at the wide receiver and the defensive back position, I think is the positions that most are going to focus on. And that's what we did with Shane Hallam tonight at Draft Countdown. And Steve Palazzolo of Pro Football Focus, always love talking NFL ball with Steve. He joined us early on in the program. He's a very busy guy this time of year, and we certainly appreciate Steve's time with us here on Hacker After Dark. We'll be back on Monday. Now, next week, the lineup's a little different for the week. Blue moves up because Frank and Hayes are on vacation, so you'll get Rick along with Lauren from 3 to 6, and I will be on 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock next week, so 6 to 8. For Hacker After Dark, and we do hope that you join us then. Dylan Denmark was your producer tonight. Dylan, great job as always. I'm the hacker, Ryan Green. And again, Jacksonville, thank you for spending part of your Friday evening and part of your week with us here on Hacker After Dark. As always, we can't tell you enough how much we appreciate it. So for all of us here on HAD, have an absolutely terrific remainder of your Friday evening and a fantastic weekend. And we will do it all over again Monday night right here on Hacker After Dark, beginning at 6 o'clock. Until then, good night, Jacksonville.